It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1, and joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, I do want to remind you, don't hesitate to go to the website, harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And more importantly, don't hesitate to seek out legal advice and just a simple phone call. Just to start things, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And with that introduction, good afternoon, Wes. Good afternoon, Cecil. Cecil, what is our topic for today?
Good afternoon, Lockwood. We're happy to be here today and have Wes here. So many times he's in court
right on
Tuesdays, or every day, actually. But we're all here together today, so that's a good thing. So, Lockwood, Wes and I want to discuss today the topic of guardianship, kind of decipher once again what that is and how that gets framed up. There have been some recent changes in our guardianship law, which now finally there's been enough time to go by for there to be kind of a development of this issue. It's called least restrictive means. We're going to explain that in a minute. When it first was legislated, if you will, we were a bit, what does that mean? How is that going to apply? But now we kind of are beginning, the clerks of court and who adjudicate these matters, as well as the lawyers. Certainly, we lawyers here at Harvell and Collins, we now are seeing how this new twist in our guardianship law comes into play. But before we get there, real quickly, Lockwood, the guardianship proceeding is basically when we have a loved one that has gotten to a point that they are unable to either take care of themselves personally, their person. They are at risk as a result of, you know, not taking their medication, getting lost at night in the middle of the neighborhood, doing very unsafe things in the home to the point that their person is at risk of injury or harm to themselves. And then many times the companion to this is that their assets are at risk. They're not able to maintain their accounts. They really don't even know necessarily where their accounts are located. There is the very real possibility of fraudulent activity when someone is not, you know, following their finances very, very closely. We all, even those of us of very much diligence this day and time, are having to be very careful about fraud and duress on our account holdings. It's happening to all sorts of us. Well, we can only imagine how that then is elevated in a situation where there's an elder person who really cannot make the phone calls, make the inquiries, keep accurate records on their accounts. There are two avenues to a guardianship: the guardianship of the person, the guardianship of the property, many times just called the general guardian. And our law firm is very involved in this on an everyday basis. And it can be a very involved matter. Now, with that said, real quickly again, what we want to have in place, Lockwood, is that infamous durable power of attorney. And if we have a power of attorney, and if the agent under the power of attorney is acting appropriately under the power of attorney and is helping mom or dad or grandmama, granddaddy with their personhood and with their assets, then potentially we will not be in the guardianship court. And at that, let me now turn it over to Wes. Wes, that's correct, right? That's the key ingredient here under the new law, is the interplay of this durable power of attorney and other kinds of things that are of a least restrictive means than adjudicating someone incompetent, right, Wes?
That's right. That's the new standard that we now have to apply. It's referred to in short LRA, least restrictive alternative. So what are these alternatives that we're talking about here, Lockwood. These are things like what Cecil just mentioned. Is there a power of attorney in place? Okay, is that working? Have the assets been structured in a, let's say, a trust? I was in a CLE, continuing legal education, last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, on this issue, and the presenter through the North Carolina Bar Association got into the issue of use of a irrevocable type trust to place assets in for the usually elderly person to protect them from fraud, protect them from, you know, those who are trying to take those assets from the person. And that we've been using that tool at Arvell and Collins for probably 15 years. And that's the first time in a continuing legal education seminar I've ever heard a presenter, you know, make that kind of suggestion. But the presenter went through all kind of issues, all kind of tools to use to try to avoid a guardianship that falls under that category of these alternatives, the LRAs, the least restrictive alternatives. So let me contrast this briefly. What it used to be, Lockwood, was that if you had an adult, we're talking about incompetency, you had someone who was incompetent, and that's the threshold, used to be the threshold determination. So it was more of like a medical determination. You put on evidence with regard to, you know, issues involving maybe the person not being able to pay his or her bills, not being able to, maybe being taken advantage of by someone, not being able to drive a car, maybe, you know, getting lost, you know, these type of things. Medical evidence with regard to maybe a neuropsych examination or a mini mental examination as to whether they had actually a presentation from a medical standard of cognitive decline, dementia, Alzheimer's, these type things. And then in the event that the clerk of court made the determination after considering that evidence that the person was incompetent, meaning they lacked the capacity to be able to handle their own affairs and was maybe a danger to him or herself and to others, then automatically you then go to the point of, okay, adjudication, and then you go to the appointment of a guardian. So previously, before the statute changed a couple years ago, the standard didn't include, you know, what's going on in the person's life. Is there actually a need for a guardianship? Is there a power of attorney? Are the assets structured properly so that they, you know, can't be subject to fraud? You know, what is there a least restrictive alternative? And in reading through the materials that we've been provided as attorneys with regard to this, what the General Assembly was trying to accomplish with regard to adding this additional standard to a guardianship was that, you know, they found that there was across the state, it was maybe a little bit too easy to just get individuals adjudicated incompetent when there may not be a need, even though the person may lack capacity. So we need to look at the need first before we ever get to the issue of their capacity or appointment. Okay, these are all threshold issues. It's like you have to prove one to get to two. You have to prove two to get to three. So the issue one now is the LRA, least restrictive alternatives. So if we have a situation today under the current law where we have someone who is incompetent, let's just say that they have advanced dementia presentation, they can't handle their own affairs, but they have a proper power of attorney in place, they have a proper healthcare power of attorney in place, they are not fighting with their agent under the power of attorney. They are, in fact, their home situation is stable. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's caregivers in place. They're cooperative. There's no evidence that there's any kind of threat to their assets. Someone is taking care of the bill pay for them, let's say through a power of attorney. And there's no real issue with regard to what's going on in this person's life. Well, the clerk of court, under those circumstances, is required to make the determination that these least restrictive alternatives are working. And since they're working, we don't even get to the issue of whether the person is actually incompetent, because under the new definitions and statutes, if the least restrictive alternatives are working, we don't in North Carolina adjudicate adults incompetent anymore.
Okay.
Now, let me contrast. See, that's a pretty big change.
Uh-huh.
It is. It is. It's a dramatic change. And now that we, as I mentioned earlier, Lockwood, are kind of living through this with application in factual scenarios, Wes and I and Julia Capps at our law firm and Andrew Foster, we all are very pleased with this change. This was a very good change in the law, because this is kind of, if you will, the middle ground, and we didn't have this middle ground to stand on and to assert in the past. We were either incompetent or we either were not, and there was not necessarily this middle ground. We have this middle ground occurring occasionally in the law firm. Now, we still have, you know, the cases to the right and the cases to the left, and we have those. But we also now are seeing where this new law can really be applied in a very productive and advantageous way for a family.
So let me contrast that, Lockwood, with the type of situations where there may be a power of attorney in place, and there may be an argument that there's least restrictive alternatives in place. Therefore, there wouldn't be an adjudication, but it's still necessary for there to be an adjudication. The most common situation is where you have a power of attorney in place, but you have a defiant principal. You mm-hmm. have a defiant, incompetent adult who's not following and not willing to abide by, you know, basically the suggestion of the power of attorney to their detriment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because then guess what? I mean, we follow this, make this tracks. The power of attorney is not working, because the power of attorney, it doesn't take away the rights of the principal to make decisions for himself or herself. He just gives someone else the authority to be able to make those decisions for them along with the mm-hmm. principal. So if the principal under the power of attorney, this would be the incompetent adult, you know, is not tracking and not willing to, is being defiant, put it that way.
Right.
That there would be a need to override their decision making for purposes of protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea there with regard to that. We could have a situation where the agent under the power of attorney, let's say there's two children. Okay, let's say the agent under the power of attorney is one of the two children. Let's say we have evidence that the agent under the power of attorney, the one child, has stolen money from dad, okay, who's the principal. Well, just because there's a power of attorney in place doesn't mean that we can't have an adjudication under that circumstance.
Right.
Because you see, in the event that agent under the power of attorney, the one child, is stolen from dad, well, and let's say it's a sizable amount of money, someone needs to do something about that. And in the event that there was some conversation in the family and this person has stolen the money, you know, isn't returning the money, that kind of thing, well, that claim, to deal with that properly, is dad's claim. it's not a sibling's claim. Mm-hmm. The other sibling can't do anything legally because they don't have the authority to do it, because the agent under the power of attorney is the child who stole the money.
Mm-hmm.
So under that scenario, even though there's a power of attorney in place, that is not a least restrictive alternative that's working. So there would be a need there, if dad is incompetent, to have an adjudication and to have perhaps the other child be appointed as guardian, so that that other child can properly address the issues with regard to the power of attorney child stealing the money. Okay. So, you know, like Cecil said, we have the cases to the left and to the right. I've just given you a couple of examples there. But there are certainly situations, you know, where there's a power of attorney in place, but still it's necessary to proceed forward with a guardianship, just depending on the circumstances.
You know,
now, and let me mention one more thing. I'll kick it back to you. But, you know, sometimes we see guardianship petitions for adjudication of incompetence, appointment of a guardian. We see these filed not really because the person who's filing them, who under this scenario would normally be the child, not really to protect the parent, but the person has filed it because the child feels like they want to have more control.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep in mind, this is the purpose of guardianship is not to satisfy the wants of the child. The purpose of the guardianship is to protect the respondent. So if you have a child who just feels like they ought to be the one in control, and I don't care if mom or dad appointed my brother, I want to be the one that's in control. So I'm going to file a guardianship, and I'm going to get the court to appoint me so I'm the one that's in control. Well, that is precisely a scenario that this LRA requirement, this least restrictive alternative requirement, is designed to not allow. Is we don't need to have these somewhat frivolous guardianship type matters just because we have a disgruntled child who feels like they should be able to be more involved in mom's life or dad's life. That's not what the purpose. It's never been what the purpose of guardianship is about. It's always about protecting the incompetent adult. Now, if we have proper power of attorney in place, maybe, you know, even a trust to protect assets, that's even better. That, you know, if mom or dad are getting the health care they need, they're safe in the home, their assets are not in jeopardy, everything is set up properly and things are working, then in this state, we're not allowed to even get to the point, to the issue as to whether they're incompetent or not. So, the point is always about what is necessary to protect the interest of the respondent, the incompetent adult, not to satisfy the wants of a child.
You know, one of the things that you bring this up as being a major event in the issue of guardianship. One of the things that we've talked about in the past, Cecil and Wes, and again, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal, is the challenge that families have when they have to come to that point where they the discomforting factor, they suddenly decide we really do need to take hold of the situation, and we're going to have to seek a declaration of incompetency. Very difficult for some family members. I'm thinking that in some instances this may actually mitigate that problem if in fact the principal or responded, as you just used the term a moment ago, Wes, if the right. principal and respondent have already set up a power of attorney, then it sort of, I gather, sort of relieves the family of the tension of having to go through that process. Is that one of the other benefits of this?
It does, Lockwood, as long as I have a file like this just last week. It was identical to what you're talking about.
Okay.
The son comes in from Virginia. Many times they are in a different state. Their parent is lived. Their parent now is a single parent, is mm-hmm. widowed, and lost the mom. There's not still mom and dad. There's just mom. She's living alone. She lives here in Carteret County. The son, he is the only child living in a different state. And all of these very frightening things are occurring with regard to not only his mother's person, as we discussed earlier, but also her property. Mm-hmm. Mysterious things, you know, out of her account, $10,000 here, $10,000 there. He, of course, immediately calls the office with the inquiry with the statement on our schedule that I'm going to need to file a guardianship for my mother. And I understand that you at Harvell and Collins, that you folks do that. So he's set down for an appointment. He comes in. We have a good appointment. Well, I, of course, immediately would move to this durable power of attorney. Do you have it? No, I don't have it. Will your mother sign it? I don't know, Mr. Harvell. I don't think that she will, but maybe she will.
Right.
And I don't know that she'll understand completely what she's signing. And I said, well, we need to, and here we go, Lockwood, a lot of what we're talking mm-hmm. about this morning, Wes and I. Well, we need to attempt to talk with your mother about the advantages of her having a well-drafted, durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, well, let me go get her and bring her in. She's very physically, she's very strong, Mr. Harvell. She drives. She,
right.
you know, we're mm-hmm. going to dinner tonight at a restaurant that she likes, et cetera, et cetera. So he goes and he gets her and he brings her in. And she is, you know, she's generally okay, and she right. did want to sign a power of attorney, and of course we very promptly prepared one for her to sign, and we got that accomplished. Now, the question is going to become, and the son knows this, is that will she now allow the son right. to really act completely under the recorded power of attorney?
Mm-hmm.
Is she going to play interference with that? That's the factual scenario that we then see where notwithstanding the fact that there is a power of attorney, the principal is revoking it or changing
right.
it, or no, I'm not going to go along with that, or no, I don't cooperate with that. And so then our hands are kind of forced into the court order, which is the guardianship order, because the least restrictive alternatives are not working in
right.
that scenario. And so this file is lingering out there, and we'll see. He was going to call me back this week and kind of give me a status report of how things were going when he went to go and change accounts and talk to his mother about them. He wants to deed the property to an irrevocable trust, and
mm-hmm.
will she sign the deed on her paid-for home place? And so we're working on the file, and we'll see how she cooperates. We are hoping, of course, that she will. And maybe she will. But if she doesn't, then our hands might be forced to move in the other direction. So that's somewhat of the framework of how the other kind of file can come, the factual scenarios that we're presented with. Will the principal allow the document to take effect? Will they allow the document to really have validity, or are they going to go behind the scenes and document, change the document,
right.
not go along with cooperating with signing other documents such as a trust or a deed or changing the account statements, things of that nature?
You know, the other aspect of this, and of course, we're seeing a change in demographics, and I want to touch on one other quick item, and that has to do with minors, but we are seeing a lot of change in demographics, and a baby boomer's now aging out. It does, and we've talked about this many times before, it does pay to sort of think ahead, to plan. And of course, that's one of the benefits of talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins at Harvell and Collins. And that is the planning to avoid unnecessary conflicts, unnecessary. And as we just heard a moment ago, it doesn't necessarily eliminate the possibility, but attempts to avoid or, yes, I think the term is avoid potential conflicts as best as possible. I'm curious in the situation of minors in the case of guardianships as well. And I'm talking about a young family, for example, who may unfortunately die and they leave behind a minor child. Under those circumstances, what is available to the family, let's say the grandparents or the aunts and uncles and things of this nature, is there, and this may be a longer conversation, but I'm just curious, is there a structure for that as well, Cecil, Wes?
It falls under the same statute.
Okay.
Under guardianship. And, you know, this is normally, you know, going to be in a situation where, unfortunately, like you said, the parents have passed away. So the standard is that, you know, the best interest of the child, mm-hmm. you know, with regard to who the guardian would be. And this can be a very highly contested issue, you know, as you could imagine.
I can.
You have a minor child and you have maybe competing grandparents
mm-hmm.
or you have aunts and uncles.
Right.
And it can be just an absolute, you know, full out litigation issue with mm-hmm. regard what's in the best interest of the child. We get into issues with regard to, obviously, how old the child is. Have they established, a home in a particular area? Where do the competing applicants, where do they live?
Right.
Where would the child have to move to? These type of things. What we really like to see here, Lockwood, is we like to see a designation of who the guardian would be in the event of unfortunate death of the parent. That is a standard provision in any properly drafted will.
Okay.
It could also be done in a separate document, but our statutes are very specific in that the clerk of court, unless there are extenuating circumstances, shall follow that identification of who the guardian, you know, would be for a minor child. I mean, in the event that, you know, we have one parent living, then obviously that they're legal guardian anyway. But if both have passed away, then we're looking, number one, for that document. Whereas, did they have a will? You know, did they have a designation?
Right.
And that type of thing. Just telling someone I want,
right,
you know, so-and-so to be the guardian is not sufficient. You have to do that in a properly drafted document that the court can consider under the statute, and that really resolves the issue if that decision has been made in the document, you know, by the parent or parents.
You know, as we come to close on this, Cecil and Wes, and that was Wes Collins a moment ago, the whole concept here is a matter of, I'm going to use the term, planning, and everything from a new family, husband and wife, children, things of this nature, changes in their family life, but also preparations for expansion into old age is and retirement. This requires planning. The benefit of going to see you at Harvell and Collins is a savings not only of money and time, but I would think also an issue of emotional stress. As I wrap it up with that, is that am I accurate in that description?
No question about that. I mean, some things we can't avoid. I mean, obviously,
right.
You could have a power of attorney and a trust in place and do all the planning, and there still may be
a
necessity to seek a guardian. I mean, mm-hmm. that may be the case, but I can tell you by having your planning in place, your documents in proper order, you're absolutely minimizing the chances that your family at some point in time is going to have to go through, you know, a guardianship provision or a guardianship process.
Right.
So, yes, same thing with regard to the minors is a great question. You know, you can really resolve any type of protracted type of litigation relative to you know, who the guardian of the minor is if you just have that proper designation. So that's that certainly would avoid a lot of heartache for any family. No question, Lockwood, that the most difficult cases, you know, that we see when we're dealing with these situations is, you know, when there's a complete lack of planning. Mm-hmm. Even in the adult guardianship situation, right. Although we talked about LRAs today mainly, when we do get to the issue of who the guardian would be, if we have a properly drafted power of attorney, then that power of attorney would have a designation of who the principal's appointed guardian would be. And unless there are extenuating circumstances, like, you know, maybe the selected guardian in the power of attorney is, you know, in jail, mm-hmm. or, you right. know, has had some serious health issue or been in an accident or something like that, then the wishes of the principal are going to be followed by the clerk if we get to that point. Good so, point. You know, no question that when we have a complete lack of planning and then we have a factual situation that hits a family, you know, whether it be a, an Alzheimer's situation or dementia, or it could be an immediate onset type thing like a stroke or something significant like that, that makes it more difficult to get a nice, clean, proper, efficient resolution to address whatever that issue is, as opposed to if we had the, you know, the powers of attorney in place.
We've spoken, Lockwood, many times about this, just real quickly, mm-hmm. about this very thing. Remember, we've spoken about the fact that when you appoint your executor in mm-hmm. your will, when you appoint your agent under your power of attorney, when you appoint the guardian of your minor child in your last will and testament, well, goodness gracious, these are written, notarized mm-hmm. statements that you have made while you are living, and the court is going to support you in your decision. I mean, who knows better who should be our executor, who should be our trustee, who should right. be our power of attorney, who should be our guardian, than the person who is the principal.
Right.
So absent some extraordinary circumstances, such as some of those that Wes just rattled off, the court is generally going to support the named executor, the named power of attorney, the named guardian, because after all, that is who the principal elected to put in their document and went so far as to have a document prepared, you know, many times by a lawyer. So the court is going to support you in those appointments, absent there just being some extraordinary extenuating circumstance.
Again, we've mentioned this many times before. A simple phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Go online to HarvellandCollins.com. Spell out the word and, HarvellandCollins.com. Speak with either Cecil, Wes, or any of the number of outstanding attorneys there in the office. Make the effort, plan. It's the simplest thing to do. And I would say, based on all the years of talking with Cecil and Wes, it is the least expensive process that you will ever have. Both Cecil, Wes, thank you for your time today. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank Bye. You.